Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show. And welcome to the 265th show of Money Matters, your economic forum entitled The Market Route. Before we begin, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Views expressed are my opinions only, or the guests of articles that I may have on or read on the show. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, KBMR, its staff, members, or underwriters, or this community radio station. So before we begin the market route, I have a letter from a listener, and occasionally I read these. Mark watched episode 2 of the Netflix series Dirty Money last night, very troubling to me. If you have watched it, I highly suggest you do, and soon too. Show got me thinking about news articles I've seen recently that most people don't have $500 in the bank or available for unexpected expenses. Wonder how many think payday loans are the only choice to find themselves in a near endless loop paying usurious rates and refi charges, payday not being the name of the company, just reference a payment salary loan. I see there are now a few lenders in Grass Valley, these advance your paycheck sort of thing. So there must be a demand I'd like to see diminished. My thought is a locally, possibly nonprofit business that would provide short-term loans to locals as interest rates lower than what you might see on these salary lenders. I'm not a financial guy, far from it. I'm financially secure, I hope, and I think I would never borrow from one of these lenders. I'd like to see that my fellow Nevada County neighbors do not find themselves in a high-rate loan trap. I don't know how this might be accomplished, but I'm willing to chip in some money to help the effort along. You're the only financial person I'm aware of, and I know you feel strongly about the health, both physical and financial, of our neighbors, so you're the lucky recipient of my email. Get back to me with a thought or two, a name or two, and let's see what happens. Thanks for your newsletter and show on KVMR, Community Radio Station. Sincerely, DM. Yeah, DM. You know, I've had similar musings and similar thoughts about those high-interest loans. I just think they're poison. You know, it's like giving a drug addict more drugs. And that you should, cut them off. And let them get out of the circle of these higher interest rates. Annual interest rates in some of those are really, really brutal. Probably be cheaper going to the mafia. So I don't like them. I can't do anything about it. Regulations prohibit me doing anything about something like that. But I do think that they aren't beneficial. But, you know, I've seen arguments that they are very beneficial to people. So I guess it just depends on which side of the aisle you decide to sit your chiquisca on, right? So thank you for your letter. And you can always send a letter to me at moneymatters@kvmr.org. Or you can send it into your program director at the station. And they'll be glad to forward it on to me. So, yeah. Did you guys have fun the last 2 weeks? Or those of you that have money in the market? Wow. That was the most historic rout in speed and viciousness, I guess I should say, since 08 and 09. Now, percentage-wise, it was only a 10% correction. So I think I'd mentioned a couple of shows back, a 5 or a 10% correction. We hadn't had one in a long, long time. And so it did kind of hit around 10%, I believe. Started at 5, rebounded, and then bang, down it went again. And it was about a 10% correction. And, it washes out what we call as the weak hands. The Dow now is up 234 at 25,128 with a high of 26,616. So we've always talked about these major support and resistance levels. The major support was 26,000, blew down through there, headed down through a variety of support levels in the 25,000s and blew down through 25,000. Don't recall whether it got into the 23s. I think it did. And so it blew through 26, 25, and 24. Major support levels, and technicians are always saying there's many, many support levels all through there, according to what they see on their charts. So 10% correction. What was interesting about this correction, it was vicious. You know, it was quick. You know, we had an 1,100 and something drop one day. It was down 1,575 points on that particular day. Ended up down 1,175. Percentage-wise, it wasn't a lot. You know, it's brutal, but wasn't as bad as it's been. And then it kind of rebounded, and then down it went again, another 500-600. So what happened last Friday, you know, I think I penned an article on it. Well, there are things, there are emotions in stock charts. You know, we chart price, prices in a graphic chart. And there are things in investing world called a climax top or a climax bottom. And nothing is for sure in markets, but what they look for in these climax tops or climax bottoms is, let's say a stock, a climax top would be a stock is running and it's running and it's running and it's running, and then it kind of runs to the higher, and then it starts to jump around fairly viciously. So it runs and runs up, 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 and then it drops down, and then it bounces up high, and then it drops down lower, and then it bounces up high. And it's having these real wild swings. And if a stock had been running, we can only say in hindsight, you can never really predict where it's going to go. But in hindsight, we look at those brutal movements as an indicator that the stock could change direction. So if it's running up and it goes through a climax top, it bounces around at the top there, that could be a sign that, uh-oh, we could be hitting a, quote, climax top, unquote. And then it drops. So what happened is the last Friday, the Dow had been down 300, and then it rebounded the midday to end up, I think, 300. And I came out and said, that looks like a climax bottom, a capitulation sell, and everybody starts jumping in the market. And although we can't tell what's going to happen in the future, that prognostication that it was a climax bottom, it looks at least to this point that was a good call. And so climax bottom. And so you might catalog that in your brain and say that if you see a stock you hold, or even an index, you know, and they start go running up, either running up or running down, and then it starts with these wild bounces at the bottom, that you could be witnessing a climax top or bottom, and that may mean there's a change of direction coming. Note the word may. Okay? May. So there you go. If it did get down to 23,000s, I could probably find that out by reaching over, but then I'd pull me away from the mic. Well, maybe I can do that anyway. So we'll click on the Dow 30. There are many indexes, S&P 500, NASDAQ, and Russell. So let's see. Let's go scroll up a one-month chart. So the low was February 9th at 23,452. So there you go. That was the low on the 9th, it looks like, if I got my charts right. And the top was 26,616. And so now it's gone from 23.5 to 25.1. And it looks to be the volatility has kind of died off a little bit, or a lot of bit. We look at volatility, I do, by looking at a representative index, representative tracker, should I say, security by the VXX. There's also the VIX. One is a subset of the other. And it was running just straight down for, you know, a year, two, 3 years, just down, 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 and ended up down around 12 or 13. And then when this sell-off happened, that thing jumped up to 53, I think it was high was. So it you know, quintupled. And today, I think it's probably sitting in the 40s. Let me see, I can pull that up for you. And let's see. VXX. Remember, this is not a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Investing involves risk and you can't lose money. VXX is at 42.11, down a little bit off. So there you go. There you go. Okay. So there we are, up 261 right now as we speak, which is 12:18 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Thursday, February 15th. You could be listening to the show on another community radio station at a different time, so that index may not be applicable or accurate at the time you hear this show. But today, if you're listening to the show live, it is accurate. 25-120-154. So we'll see what happens. You know what was interesting is this vicious sell-off was across the board. And there are kind of like lights that I look at, to indicate how severe a market correction would be. And so think of it, if you've ever seen a drag race, you see multiple lights, right? It goes red, orange, 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 green, and then the guys take off. Well, this is the reverse. And these are by no means set in stone. These are my own observations and my own theories. So the first light when I see the market get upset is stocks drop. Okay? Stocks drop. And when stocks drop, people sell stocks and the money comes out and they place it somewhere else. And then you can place it down the line to the other lights. So first thing I see is stocks drop, and that's first light. And I say, okay, stocks are dropping. Then it bleeds over to junk bonds, which can be held in what they call income funds. So if you hold income funds, it could hold some junk bonds. Junk bonds are notes from companies that have to pay a higher interest rate because their financials may not be as good as companies that have better financials. Junk bonds. A lot of times they're put in income funds to spike the yield over savings rates, which, as you know, savings rates in the bank is pretty bad. So stock markets jump, and then money may be allocated to the income funds or junk bonds. And then if those start to sell off, that's the second warning light. I go, that's interesting. Junk starting to sell off. And it may go over to corporate bonds. And then money may travel over to corporate bonds or further down the line. And then if I see corporate bonds start to sell off, then that's another light. That's when it gets kind of interesting. It's like, oh, this is getting pretty interesting here. We had stocks and then income funds, junk bonds. And then we had corporate bonds starting to sell off. That's when it gets pretty serious, when you start to see the bond market get upset. And it did get upset. And then if it bleeds over to what is perceived as more reliable fixed income in some people's minds, it might bleed over to preferred stocks, utilities. Those might start to sell off. Now, those might usually sell off in a market up direction. But in a severe market downturn, then utilities and those things could start to sell off. And in this last route, they did. And then it could bleed over to municipal bonds and state bonds. That when that happens, then you've really got problems. That's the fourth warning light, or the fifth warning light. And that indicates that things are really getting serious. And we did see it kind of stop around utilities and municipal funds. Not quite sure if they sold off a lot. So we were getting down into the scary area, at least for me when I look at it. And also, and there would be mortgage-backed securities that are mostly guaranteed by the U.S. government. And then if it really gets bad, then you start to see unemployment start to rise. And then you start to see real estate itself start to sell off. And that's when it really, really starts to get serious. And last time we saw that, of course, was in the crisis. You saw stocks and then junk bonds sell off. And then it bled over to corporate bonds. And then it bled over to utility stocks and preferred stocks, and then it bled over to municipal bonds and state bonds. And the only thing that was really, really safe was U.S. Treasuries, you know, cash equivalents. And I always said people in the crisis that hold savings never saw any problem. You know, I saw a lot of people that were afraid to open up their portfolios during the crash of 08 and 09, but they did not know. I knew anybody that was afraid to open up their bank savings statement because that didn't move, right? And so this last sell-off, we did see, you know, two or three lights go off, and it was pretty wide-based sell-off. So it was surprising in that range. The velocity was a little stunning. You know, it's been a while since I've seen a 1,000-point sell-off. I don't think I'd ever seen a 1,000-point sell-off. I think back, during the taper tantrum, I think we saw 1,000 points in 15 minutes, but that was attributed possibly to a fat finger. Somebody made a bad trade. But we'll never really know, do we? They always say something, but you'll never know. But this one was broad-based and a lot of lights, and I was looking at it. But one of the strategies I use to reduce, to make sure I don't get stopped out. Now, what stopped out means that, you know, like a slot machine. You go into the casino and you play a slot machine and you lose $100. Some people it's 20, some people it's $500. And you basically say, I've lost enough, I'm out. Okay? You don't go back into your ATM and say, well, I'm down too far now, I can't stop, and just completely empty your bank account. But a lot of investors and advisors fall victim to that trap. You know, they always say, well, it's not down far enough, not down far enough, not down far enough. And then one minute they say it's not down far enough. And then the second minute your mind switches to it's down too far, I don't want to sell now. So you really never had an out. Now, you don't use that strategy when you're gambling at a casino. You don't say, I'm not down far enough, I'm not down far enough, I'm not down far enough. And then switch to, I'm down too far, I can't get out now. No, what you do is you walk away. You walk away. So, but what you don't want to do is get stopped out of a market that turns and runs again. And so one of the methods I use, besides diversification into fixed income and a wide base, is that let's say I hold 10 positions in a portfolio, okay? And I have a 10% stop on everything. So if it drops, any one position drops 10%, I sell. When I start to perceive that the market is looking scary to me, what I'll do in portfolios is I will widen the amount of holdings. So instead of holding 10, I might hold up to 40 or 50, which is a lot to track. But with my trading programs, I can unload and unload 40 stocks and 60 portfolios in a matter of 5 minutes. So it's, to me, it's not really problematical. So what I'll do is I'll go from 10 positions out to 40 positions. But I will not no longer have a 10% stop on it. I might put it at 20. Because a 5% 10% correction in the market is, you know, normal. Not normal, but it's, you know, regarded as healthy, and it happens. 20% drop in stocks would have been what? It's 5,000, 6,000 point drop in the Dow would have ended up down in the 20,000 or 19,000. But I don't want to get stopped out on what I perceive might be a temporary upset. Now, I myself, my opinion that the economy looks good, strong, and the earnings are coming in pretty good. And so I felt that this was just a technical correction. So I widened out the number of positions in a portfolio. So in other words, now I hold 40, but I widened the stops to 20% down. So the market would have had to drop 20% for me to start to be exercised out of those positions. Now, what it also does is that you not only hold a wider base of securities, which in itself helps diversify. And what happens is each security will hit a 20% out at a different time. So instead of having 10% of your portfolio, if you have 10 positions sold out at 10%, I've got 40 positions with 20% stops. There'll be a few, if the market continues to tumble, that will be hit 20 and execute, bang. So instead of getting 10 positions and all of a sudden I've liquidated one because it's down 10, and now I'm out 10% of my investment portfolio, not necessarily the value of the whole portfolio, because remember, if you drop 10% in 10 positions, you've lost what? 1% of the portfolio, if I've done my math right. So by having 40 positions at a 20% stop, if the market drops 10%, the odds are most of those securities are not going to hit a 20% stop. Some will. And so they'll gently get me out in 40 different steps if it continues to go down. So it's gently converting stuff to cash over a wider spectrum of assets. So as the market would sell off, it would have to be really broad-based to wipe out all 40 positions. I mean, I don't think that even possible. I guess anything is possible. So I widen out the amount of holdings from 10 to 40 or 30 or 50 or whatever. And then I know with a 20% stop on each one of those, if the market continues to rock and roll, all of a sudden these positions start popping out, turning to cash. So it's a gentler way to start getting out of the market, and it makes sure that I don't get stopped out. And that is what happened. And in the portfolios that I had, it performed the way I expected it to perform, which is good. But I talked to a lot of people that were stopped out, you know, 10%. They got 10% stopped out and another 10% stopped out. And because the market stopped, then those 40 positions were a lot more defensive, at least in my opinion they were. Some might argue that, and I'm not one to say this is a science. This is not a science. Economics is a social science. It's really just the analyzing the perception of all the players in the market at one time. They may not mean anything. I mean, you could get a sell-off in a very healthy economy. It doesn't mean anything. It just means more people hit the sell button. So, when I was really young, I had one stock that I had that had dropped a lot, and I asked my broker at that time, why did I get stopped out, you know, as a young kid? And he said, well, you know, there's more sellers than buyers. And that's what makes the market go up, more sellers than buyers. It makes the market go down. If you have more buyers than sellers, the market goes up. And it's so indicative even to individual issues. So that's one way you might look. And then if I perceive that the market is running again, then I might reduce the amount of positions just for sheer manageability of it. But at this time, I'm not reducing yet. I'm just keeping an eye on it. There is something called a double bottom. That's also another theory, or a triple bottom. It means that for an index to fully correct, it has to hit the lows twice. And so is another double bottom coming? It's hard to say, you know. We did see sort of a double bottom on February 6th. The index hit 25,150. So, and then it corrected up, and it hit 25,207, and then it rocketed down again. So some might say that that's a double bottom, and we'll see. There was no real indication, at least that I could see, on the Dow of a double top. Basically, it hits it twice. And so the only thing I see is January 26th. It hit 26,616, its high, and then it started to drop and pop back up again to 26,186. You could say that was a double top, but who knows? Right, that's the real key, right? Who knows? So it was brutal. It was vicious. It had a terrible acceleration to it. It had broad-based. So it was definitely, you know, someone to bite your knuckles over, for sure. And like I said, I saw good earnings and everything. I wasn't really too concerned. I was concerned anytime the market drops and balances drop. You're always concerned. So there you go. It was interesting. Prior to the sell-off, I had just penned an article. In fact, it didn't even get out on most media outlets, called The Melt Up. And so I revised the article, and here's what I said. I said, truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. A week back or so, which is now 3 weeks back, I penned an article called The Melt Up, which detailed the great run-up in stocks and how rare it is to see such a sustained rally that we saw before the correction. Also detailed in that article was the caveat that the melt up is, quote, usually followed by a meltdown, from investors.com. No sooner did the article hit the wires, and I didn't even get the article out on some wires, did the market start to crater, and in a big way. From the high of 26,616 on the Dow, January 26th of this year, last couple of weeks saw wild gyrations almost daily. It culminated with a handle-gripping 1,175-point drop on February 5th. It had been down 1,579 midday, so I guess it could have been worse. We could have closed down that far, right? But it did recover some. We can make an educated guess as to why the downalanche, I made that up, the downalanche, like an avalanche, downalanche. We can make an educated guess as to why the downalanche started, but the cause, which was touted by some, was that the Federal Reserve would raise interest rates after an economically positive unemployment number came out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In other words, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that publishes such things, came out and said that unemployment was not bad. It was a pretty good number. Not as in a lot of unemployed, but a lot of people were employed and not a lot of people were unemployed. So the question is, why does good economic news call a stock sell-off? Why does good economic news cause a stock sell-off? But it seems to be the new norm in the last decade or so. And what is that reason is a perplexing question. Not so perplexing, however, say many analysts, and this is my view. With the Federal Reserve coming to the rescue after the 08-09 crisis and repeating program after program to stave off periodic sell-offs in the market, investors apparently learned a Pavlovian type of response. Remember Pavlov's dog, right? You ring a bell and he salivates after you feed him every time you ring the bell. The Pavlovian type of response from investors is knee-jerking the market up or down in response to not what economic fundamentals are telling us, but what we think the Fed will do in response to those economic fundamentals and the response to the economic statistics. So in this particular case, the economic statistics were positive. And some say that caused the market to sell off because you said, uh-oh, if the unemployment's going down and the market's starting to, quote, heat up, get better, the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates. Right? It all revolves around the elixir that the Federal Reserve administrates and also central banks around the world when it comes to, quote, monetary stimulus. When the economy drops, they'd like to put stimulus in, monetary stimulus, which is to say how they respond to stock market falls or economic news. Historically, the Feds will drop interest rates to goose an economy or rescue one, and increase rates to cool off an economy that's running too hot. Too hot would mean there's employment pressure, employers can't find people to work, the wages are increasing, and prices are rising. It all revolves around the elixir that the Fed administrates, and we call those one of them. One of the tools they use is interest rates. With interest rates near zero for 8 years running since 2009 and 2008, some believe that the Dow's quadrupling, which it did from 2009 to 2017, some believe the market's quadrupling since 2009 is solely in the response to these almost zero interest rates. When you have zero interest rates, there's a lot of money that can be borrowed, and some of that finds its way into the stock market. So they kept interest rates near zero for a long, long time. Remember, these low interest rates are supposed to be emergency rates. Fed says they're emergency rates. Well, a lot of people would say, well, after 2009, where was the emergency? I mean, sure, the economy hadn't recovered, and the stock market hadn't recovered to where it was prior, but was it an emergency for the last 8 years? I didn't see them coming on the news and saying, we have a tremendously drastic situation in the economy for the last 8 years. I don't remember saying that. The theory being that with this improved employment number that came out, that the Feds would raise rates, and the logical conclusion would be the markets would fall. Because when you lower rates, they want the market to rise, and everybody knows when you raise rates, the theory they do that is the belief that the market will rise. So the reason is that they thought, okay, good unemployment number, the Feds are going to raise rates, and the investors are acting preemptively to this belief. Once it took hold, the sell-off started to pull, then everybody said, oh, time to jump ship, and, you know, the market is made up of two emotions, greed and panic. Right? So they were acting, perhaps, preemptively to this belief. Now, it's indeed counterintuitive to think good economic statistics would trigger market sell-offs, but the proof is in the proverbial pudding. A good unemployment number hit the wires when the sell-off began. And when another bit of good news hit February 8th, jobless claims came in at a four-year low, the market started down hard again. In my opinion, this type of sell the good news, buy the bad, where market direction is now more influenced by Fed monetary policy, interest rates in this particular case, more influenced by Fed monetary policy than economic fundamentals, which is earnings are good, this sets a dangerous precedent and also a confusing picture to the average investor. It's confusing. The markets, you could say, well, the economy's getting better, I should buy stocks, and all of a sudden the good news comes out and the market tanks. So it is a confusing picture to the average investor. The question now becomes, do you buy stocks when the economy shows signs of weakness because you believe the Fed will rescue it? Or do you buy stocks when the economy shows signs of improvement, which seems more logical? According to the recent market action, the former, which is buy stocks when the economy shows signs of weakness because you think the Feds will raise rates, the former seems to hold true, at least in this case. Considering the logic of it all and how we arrived at this point, who's to say one day the market's reaction to economic news will once again revert back to a saner evaluation of economic fundamentals? Which is to say, wouldn't it make more sense to buy stocks when the economy is improving and therefore to get the Fed out of the picture with their interest rates? You basically get the Fed out of the picture. That would mean that the Fed would have to back off trying to alter market direction with monetary policy and let the free market reign once again. Now, I know free market is a dirty word to a lot of you. Every time I put free market out on the web, I get a lot of bad emails that I believe, Cunaverde believes in the free market. He's an arse. Well, you know, I could debate that very strongly. Not that I'm an arse, but that I do believe in the free market. And people say, well, you know, the free market is what caused the 08 and 09 crisis. Capitalism would cause that crisis. No, capitalism didn't cause that crisis, folks. What caused that crisis was intervention. That's what caused it prior to the crisis. Intervention prior to the crisis by the feds and others is what caused that crisis, not free markets. Free markets correct almost everything. We have to protect the environment. We have to feed those that need food that are, you know, incapacitated. Of course, free market probably wouldn't take care of that, but actually they do when you go to these small towns. They're not forced to participate. They help their own. At least that's my opinion of it. So would it make sense to say we buy stocks when the economy is improving and remove the Fed from the picture altogether? Yes. In my opinion, the Federal Reserve should be removed from the picture. They do have a function, a Keynesian function. The Keynesian function model has been distorted. John Maynard Keynes was an economist that said this. Basically, he said, when the economy is hurting, the Fed should save money, okay? I mean, when the economy is robust, the Fed should take money and save for the day when it's not robust so they can stimulate with monetary policy, okay? That's what Keynes basically said in a nutshell. That has been distorted. Where when the economy is good, the Fed spends. And when the economy is bad, the Fed spends again. So they forgot the save part of it. But Keynes said that. Fed should save when their economy is robust, and it should help when the economy goes through a natural cycle of boom and bust. But they don't do the other side of the equation. Now it's just spend and spend, no matter what the market does. And if the market's really good, they spend even more. And we saw that in a lot of municipalities and states, you know, when the housing boom was taken off and the cities were rich in tax revenues and everybody was rich in tax revenues from all the stuff that was being sold and all the stuff that was being bought, they basically got themselves into hawk thinking that the good times would always last. And we saw a lot of cities when the crisis hit spent so much money when the crisis hit that revenue stopped as the housing market kicked in reverse and they got into trouble and some cities went broke, right? Vallejo, Stockton, I believe. There were a lot of them that just went belly up because they overspent. They didn't think, hey, we got a lot of revenue here from the housing boom. Let's save it. No, not only did they spend it, a lot of cities, states, spent it and even borrowed more to spend more. I mean, I went down Stockton and Vallejo, and man, all these great little buildings were built and all these, you know, new bus stations and everything was built. During the time of the boom. Everything was built during time of the boom because they had plenty of money and they borrowed bonds to do it as well. Man, I went to a high school and my kids' football game and this high school had been, holy mackerel, this thing looked like utopia. I mean, it spent so much money. So anyway, that's my opinion. What's yours? Well, you're listening to Money Managing your community radio station. We'll be right back.
Coming out of my mouth. Maybe I'll
And you're tuned to KVMR FM and your community radio station. If you're listening into it on another station, many community radio stations, thank you for joining me. My name is Mark Cuniberti, and this is the show Money Matters, Your Economic Forum. So a little bit more on interest rates. We have a little bit more time. We can make a statement that interest rates are said to be the gas pedal of the economy. And you push down on the gas pedal and makes the economy go, and you lift up on the gas pedal and makes the economy slow down. So when you push down, you're pushing down interest rates. And when you lift the pedal, you raise interest rates, it slows the economy down. So that'd be a good way to kind of think of this. Interest rates are said to be the gas pedal of the economy. One of the tools the Feds use. Interest rates are set by, here in the United States, the Federal Reserve. Other countries have what they call their central banks, their version of the Federal Reserve. This is one of a kind. This is one kind of what is called monetary stimulus, which means altering the money supply in circulation. So you lower interest rates, you increase the money supply. You could call it the gas pedal. The Fed pushes up and down in hopes of steering, some say manipulating, the economy. As interest rates drop, right, you lift off on the pedal, raise your foot off, rates go up. So as interest rates drop, push down on the pedal, borrowing is easier and therefore credit flows. It increases credit for margin debt, credit cards, home, auto loans, business borrowing, corporate bonds, lines of credit, banking and financial institutions, acquisitions, mergers, finance, and the bond market. The bond market is the feeding trough of business and governments. All this money from low rates gooses the economy upward. That's the hope. Low interest rates are thought to be one of the main elixirs for an ailing economy. Economy ails, slows down, you push down on the pedal, push down on rates. Recessions, depressions, and in recent times, stock market sell-offs have all been addressed by central bankers, if severe enough, by lowering interest rates, pushing the pedal down, lower interest rates. Speed up the car, give it more gas, push down the interest rates. Conversely, if the economy overheats, which means inflation would rear its ugly head and in an unacceptable rate, the Feds would consider raising rates, right? Raising rates, raise your foot off the pedal of monetary stimulus. Many analysts argue this is far from a perfect science. And one could argue just by the fact we continue to have economic tsunamis from time to time, which is depressions and recessions and the banking crisis, right? Remember the banking crisis, real estate crisis? Either the gas pedal doesn't work. If it worked, why would we have these crises, right? Or it works, but the Feds aren't very good at using it. My vote goes to checking all of the above. The inherent problem with interest rate manipulation, here's the problem with it. It takes a long time to work its magic. It's like driving a pinball machine or a ship. Let's say it's like sort of steering the Titanic. Goose the engine, and the ship is so big it takes a while to get going. Once you're going, if you fail to see a problem, like an iceberg, you can't turn it or stop it in time to avoid a crash. For the Titanic, they had too small of a rudder. And also, it was a clear night. It was like a mill pond, so you didn't see the waves breaking up on the iceberg. And it was just hard to see, and it was no moon. So you had a combination of things. Usually accidents happen because of three or more things. That's not to say the Fed doesn't know what it's doing. No comment. It literally has thousands of economists peering into the blackness of prognostication, all hoping their general consensus of what's ahead is correct. But the lag in the gearing of interest rate manipulation is a fact. You don't just don't lower the rates and tomorrow the economy takes off. It takes a while. And that lag is what I call the missing link in having it being used successfully. The scale by which interest rates work their magic, or poison, as you may have it, is tremendous. The scale is tremendous. Small movements up or down in rates and the amount of money that is affected is beyond, literally beyond comprehension. Literally trillions of leveraged dollars in the global economy gear up or down depending on the direction of the interest rate move. The more debt there is, the more the effect. So interest rates in a pure cash economy with no debt wouldn't have as much effect as it would in an economy that's laden in debt. And Lord knows we have a lot of debt, both domestically and globally. Think of the Fed's task in fictional terms of waking a cyclops, right? Don't shake the cyclops hard enough because they drink wine, right? Cyclops drink wine and they get drunk and they pass out. At least that's what I think. If you don't shake the cyclops hard enough, he won't get up. Shake him too hard and he's likely to get mad and throw a fit and tear the hell out of the surroundings, right? So you got to be careful. It's an old, odd analogy, but you get the point. Sinbad the Movie, I think they had to wake the cyclops. It's an old movie. They made a new version of it. It wasn't very good. One has to be very, very careful when messing with interest rates, which is why you see the Feds now. They're so careful, they raise it like a quarter of a point. You know, Paul Volcker, I think around 1979, 81, he jacked interest rates three points in one day. 3 points in one day. That kind of shock would send the markets to near zero, in my opinion, today. There are those that argue against the very idea of manipulating interest rates. There are some people who say, don't manipulate them. After all, interest rates are said to be the price of money, right? How much is the price to borrow money? It's interest rates. And the argument goes that the price should be determined by those using it, all us borrowers, and not by some arbitrary small group of, quote, experts. I would ask, do you think they're experts? They had control of the economy in 08 and 09, and look what happened. Also during the Depression, they just became in business in 1913. 1929 came along and wham! So I would ask you, much like going to a grocery store, would you rather decide yourself what to buy and how much you pay? Would you rather have that determined by someone else? This is the price and you have to pay it. Whatever the belief, the fact remains right now, and since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, the Federal Reserve does determine interest rates here in the United States, at least short-term overnight lending rates. That affects everything. They can't really affect interest rates along the wide scope of global interest rates forever, right? They can get away from them. They have big levers and wheels they can turn, but you know, it is possible that they could lose control. Another fact is rates have been, as I mentioned, at near historic lows for 8 years. This means the gas pedal has been pressed to the proverbial floor for an unprecedented amount of time. We haven't seen this. Some argue the pedal is not working, and some argue it's working just fine. I guess it all depends on where you sit. It could be argued the super wealthy seem to think we are cruising along just fine, while others are wondering when they'll see some movement in their financial picture. Whatever the view is from your seat, my real concern is whether we'll hit anything along the way. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. We'll be right back to end the show.
Thank you.